So this morning I'm beginning what is now the program to reduce attendance. I'm going to start a series on Calvinism. So if you don't like Calvinism, I'm sure it's going to be the case that we'll be seeing you leave in the next few weeks. It might just be maybe I'm just not as good of a preacher when I'm preaching on these things, and so you might leave. But when we talk about that phrase, that term, I should say, of Calvinism, all kinds of caricatures come into people's minds. Is it a cult? Is it a curse? Is it a projection of cruelty? Some people have almost a visceral reaction to the term Calvinism. I know of churches even recently that have had major church splits, and one of the key issues was over this theme or topic of Calvinism, whatever that is. Calvinism might be the boogeyman of modern Christianity. Sometimes people will ask me, they'll say, "Are you a Calvinist?" And I'll say, "You tell me what a Calvinist is, and I'll tell you if I am one." Yet for others, this label, and we do use labels in theology to help us kind of sort out our thinking, this label of Calvinism is a shorthand way of describing the theology of the Apostle Paul. Or the theology, more importantly, of Jesus Christ himself, certainly been testified through history as the theology of Augustine, didn't start with Calvin, has been described as the doctrines of grace. And I actually prefer that term, that phrase, the doctrines of grace, because it is all about God's undeserved favor toward us. And let's think about the ways in which that undeserved favor has been manifest. Some will see it as a theology of a big God. Big God theology. And that is maybe helpful, but a little bit more general. Certainly God is big. He's weighty in that Hebrew sense of his kavod, his glory. And we want to see that and feel, I should say, that weightiness of God. But it is the doctrine of God's initiative in a specialized saving love. That's what it is. Now, you may know that Calvinism is often connected to the so-called 5 points of Calvinism and the acronym TULIP. Of course, the flower that's famed from the Netherlands. When I was in the Netherlands last spring, it was neat to see the just massive fields of tulips. It was pretty powerful to see it all. And these 5 points of this acronym, TULIP, were responses to 5 doctrinal positions that were taken up in the Netherlands in the 16th century. And so that's where the 5 points of Calvinism come in response to 5 errors. And so the language of TULIP is, and you may know this acronym, is total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and the perseverance of the saints. Now, my wife grows tulips, and when they were covered in snow, we didn't know, are they going to survive? But of course, they can't remain hidden, and you would have them poking out from the snow because they're resilient. The tulips are very resilient, and their bloom always signals the hope of spring. And that's my hope as we look at the tulip of God's grace and all of his promises. That actually offers us this blessed hope of an eternal spring forever, even with the Lord. Now, before we're going to look at the bloom of the tulip, as it were, and that's kind of the title for my series, there's something that I want us to consider even before we get into the details and the debates of Calvinism. And it is the most important place we must begin. We must start with God. We have to start with God. And that's where we're going to start with this morning. And in thinking about God, this is where then we come to the book of Isaiah. Because the book of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, is very concerned to get Israel back to thinking rightly about God. The reason is, like for all of us, it can be very difficult for us to think about God rightly. Our own hearts and our environments press us to have wrong views of God. We might say even that it's a true God, but we are ascribing wrong things to Him. In Isaiah chapter 46, there's an extended description of what sophisticated people do when they try to think about God on their own terms, by their own references, in their own power. And it's funny how sophisticated people have not really changed that much over the centuries. So you read there in chapter 46 and verse 1. Bel bows down. Nebo stoops. This is the picture of the gods of the Babylonians, Bel and Nebo. It says, verse 1, their idols are on beasts and livestock. Well, here you have the gods of the Babylonians, very powerful nation, and these gods are their highest motivators. These gods drive them. They are their best guides. They are their most generous incentivizers in their whole society. And yet, they have to be packed around on a pack animal. Cathedrals, worship halls, temples, shrines, you name it. All of these were made for Bel and Nebo. All of these were crafted. Then there's writs and regulations. There's processes and postures. All of this practiced to honor Bel and Nebo, honor these highest motivators, these best guides, these generous incentivizers. All of it built around this entire system. And yet, their image, the image of these gods, their statue, their earthly expression is taken and it's tipped over and strapped to the back of a donkey or a mule or a steer or something, some critter. And you just imagine that, flat out, strapped down. And so these idols who are so powerfully representing the gods, they can't even sit up and ride the donkey. They just got to be strapped on, or they're going to fall off or be bucked off, I guess. You ever tried riding a donkey? Probably going to get bucked off, actually. But anyways, imagine this donkey or this steer or whatever it is. It can't save the burden that it bears. You know, these things are... These things you carry, speaking of the beasts and livestock, are born as burdens. Burdens on weary beasts. And so these idols are impotent. That's the point. They're helpless. They're powerless. And this is the way that these supposed gods, this is the way they really are. They're impotent. They're helpless. They're powerless. You see, this is the thing, is that with idols throughout history, throughout time, all of them represent false gods. And the gods, they don't have the power that they brag and claim to have. They can't do the things that they claim that they're capable of. Whereas, by contrast, what does the true God say in verse 5 of chapter 46? to whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we may be alike? So this contrast here is introduced between the true God and the idols. Verse 6, those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh out silver in the scales, hire a goldsmith, he makes it into a god, and then they fall down and worship. It's all coming out of your pocket. The thing that you're worshiping is coming out of your pocket. You are paying to create the god that you then submit yourself to. It's one of the great ironies of our day. Everybody claims their personal autonomy, and yet we will pay for things to enslave us. We will pay for things that we will then submit ourselves to. He says, verse 7, then lift it to their shoulders, they carry it, they set it in its place, stands there, cannot move from its place. If one cries to it, it doesn't answer or save him from his trouble. These gods are silent. But this is, of course, the problem. Human beings are made to worship. You know, we're described as Homo sapiens. But some have also described us as Homo liturgus, namely, man as worshiper. The question is, whom shall we worship? Whom shall we worship? It's not a matter of, well, I might worship or I might not worship. No, no, you are worshiping. You are a worshiping being. You're worshiping all the time. Who will you worship? That is the question. We are made to worship, and our hearts will not rest until they rest in God alone, as Augustine said. And so, I mean, you might be here this morning and you are just flat out burnt out. But could it be that you're burnt out because you are restless in taking money out of your pocket, chasing after the creation of idols, all so that you can run after them and fuss over them and fixate on them and submit to them and be enslaved to them? You've got the Lord, but then you want this busyness. You want this hectic pace. You want it all to chase after. Maybe it makes you feel significant, but then maybe you're making an idol of yourself, that all attention needs to be focused on you. Any direction of worship, then, that is not resting in the Lord, any direction of worship is toward an idol, toward false gods. This isn't just about ancient Israel. This applies to everything going on today, everything in your life and in mine. Idols are man's attempt to make comparable gods to compete with the true God. Let me say that again. Idols are man's attempt to make comparable gods to compete with the true God. We are in a vast competition right now. That's what's going on. We're in a vast competition, and everybody is competing for your attention. One economist described it as the attention economy. And isn't that it? You take out your phone, it's like, you know, where's your attention? Is it on your phone? You know, what billboard, what advertisement? You know, you get those tons of emails each week. I can't keep up with them. You know, just everybody's demanding attention, and it's all for stuff that I don't need. Right? You know, it just fills your inbox. But people want eyeballs. They want your attention. Well, that's what we do. We actually manufacture these comparable gods that want, that demand worship. Now, you see the consequences here then in verses 6 through 7. Gold goes to the goldsmith to make the idol. You worship the idol, you donate gold to the idol, but the idol doesn't move and the idol doesn't speak and the idol doesn't save. He doesn't save. He doesn't, verse 7, if one cries to it, it does not answer or save him from his trouble. I know you folks, and you know me, all of us, we are tempted to look to things and people or look within ourselves and trying to then make an idol where we refuse to go to God and we want to somehow have control of an idol, and yet the idol doesn't speak and the idol doesn't save as much as we want it to. It won't save us. Herbert Schlossberg has a book from early 90s called Idols for Destruction. And he said this: in a society in which idolatry runs rampant, a church that is not iconoclastic is a travesty if it is not against the idols, it is with them. And so that's what we need to be. We have to be iconoclastic. Now, what about the idols of this age? I don't need to unpack them at length, because I think it's fairly obvious for us. There is a worship of sex in our society. It is an idol. It doesn't save anyone. It doesn't speak. It doesn't speak truth. But there's an idolatry of sex. And the practices of that idolatry are such now that people are denying that not only are they not created in the image of God, but that a man can be a woman and a woman can be a man. And then we could subject our children to that, almost in a sort of child sacrifice. And we want to look back on the past and think, oh, those unsophisticated savages. We're the savages in this society. It is a savage society. And so we have to speak against those. But this isn't just about the idols. We can go on and think about the idols and how bad the idols are and all these things. But the issue for us is not to move from one inefficient idol to the next and find a supposedly better one. It's actually that we have to get our view of God right. So we have to look to God first. And this is why it says in verse 6, those, he says, to whom, he says, verse 9, he says, I am a God and there is no other. I am a God and there is none like me. He's incomparable. This is the first hint that we have. Verse 5, I should have said, to whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we may be alike? That's the verse I wanted to share. This is the first hint that God intends for us to see him as incomparable and unequaled. Incomparable and unequaled. The problem that we're starting with, and it's the problem for everyone who looks at the Bible, at Jesus Christ, the doctrines of grace, the problem is our wrong view of God. Now, John Calvin, he addressed this problem of the lack of a right view of God. And Calvin said about our mind and our thinking, and you maybe know this reference, but he said our mind is an idolorum fabricum. An idolorum fabricum. It's a forge. Has anybody watched Forged in Fire? This is one of the favorites at my household. I got three boys. Forged in Fire is it's a blacksmithing show. Like, I mean, exciting. So women have cooking shows, or they got the home improvement shows, and men have, yeah, let's beat some metal into something, you know, and lots of heat and make a sword, you know, that kind of stuff. That's this word fabricum. It's a forge, like a blacksmith's forge. Or I know lots of welders who call their welding shop a fab shop. Not because it's fabulous, it's generally not very fabulous. Because they fabricate there. It's a fabrication shop. Or the term has been described as a factory. A factory, like an assembly line. And what then does the mind make with this forge or this fab shop or this factory? What does the mind make? Well, it makes idols. Idols. It's not just one. Oh, yeah, I've got an idol in my life. Only one? It's actually this perpetual factory of idols. That's what Calvin said. The mind is a perpetual factory of idols. I'd say, if I was to update the translation from Calvin, I'd say that the mind is a perpetual algorithm of idols. And I think that's actually where we're at today, because the mind is perpetually computing and calculating and creating new idols, facilitated by the tech and everything else. So we have to conclude, as the first point, that when God says, verse 6, to whom, verse 5, to whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we may be alike? So when we come to that, when God makes that rhetorical question, we must answer, there is nobody. It's easy to say, but it's harder to believe. There is no comparison. Nobody can be likened to God. Nobody can be equal to God. Nobody can even be compared to God as being alike to God. This is why we get into all these problems when people start using an analogy for the Trinity. You know, whether it's, you know, a three-leaf clover, or whether it's, you know, water, ice, and water vapor, steam, you know, or whatever it is. These analogies to try to describe God. Well, actually, God doesn't fit into the box. Now, we're all creatures. We like patterns. We do pattern recognition, right? That's how we pick stuff up quickly. We do that because we expect things to be the same. We expect there to be everything to be, you know, same. It's all the same. You know, like Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again. That's what we expect. But God alone, I would say, in the universe, God of any being, God is unique. God is unique. He is not the same as anyone or anything else. Now, we can say, as he tells us in his word, he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. But that is because he is the same with himself. He's not the same as you. He's not the same as any other being. He is self-consistently the same. But he's not the same as us. He's not the same as anything in our mind. God is unique. And that means that we have a hard time controlling him. I said at Easter that the risen Christ, Jesus, being alive, is on the loose. He can't be controlled by you. He's on the loose. He's alive. Ascended into heaven, but he acts freely. He's thinking right now. He's willing and wishing, and he's doing all that he pleases right now. And that's when we think of God himself, theology proper, when we think of God, we can't control him. Let's think about this. There's a while ago, I had a conversation with Ahmed, who owns the pizza parlor just down the street here at Roma's Pizza. I've invited Ahmed to come to church. I mean, maybe he's here today. If you're here, welcome. Thanks for coming. But I'm just going to tell a story. So I'm talking with Ahmed, and he's a Muslim, and so we're talking, I'm sharing the gospel with him. And after a while, he just confessed to me. He said, you know, Mr. Pastor, he said, I'm a simple man. I need a simple God. And so what he was telling me was that he wanted a God that would fit within his control. He didn't want a God that was beyond his understanding, because then he wouldn't be able to fit that God into his system. And so that's what we do, though. People will worship an idol of their own mind's making and keep that idol small enough to be controlled by man. And it happens in the church, in churches. That's how people, you know, that's how they can reduce God to an idol. That Jesus is just here to be put in your back pocket, and when you need your good luck charm, you pull Jesus out and you do all the Jesus talk. And at that point, then you're all for Jesus. But the rest of the time, you just worry about you. You just do your own thing. You do you, as they say. We all like to keep him controlled. And yet, the true God is incomparable. He is truly in a class by himself. That's what God means. He is in a class by himself. Any other attempt to classify him puts him in a box. If you are trying to ascribe things to God that he has not given to you, you don't have the categories to start describing God. It has to be how he has revealed himself to us. Now, you think still, okay, how does this relate to the Calvinism? I quoted Calvin, but how does it relate to the Calvinism? Well, before we talk about tulips, Calvinism is about submitting to God and saying that God is in a class by himself, lest we become idol makers and blasphemers of God. And so, with that, I want to look first at the discrimination of God. Now, discrimination might be a bad term, but you're going to see then in verse 9, I want to zero in on this simple statement. Notice verse 9, how God describes himself. He speaks with great discrimination, and he says, I am God. Now, to our sensitive ears, we might think, that sounds arrogant. That sounds arrogant to say that he is God. You know, what about other cultures? What about other perspectives? What about the God within that we can namaste to each other? Who does this God think he is? Like, I was remembering, I was talking to a bronc rider once at a rodeo, and he was... Of course, I'm telling him, yeah, I think I, at that time, I was going to seminary, and he said, what do you do there? I said, well, we study the Bible that God gave us. And he said, well, do you study other Bibles? Other Bibles? Because it sounds arrogant to think that you would only study one God and one Bible. But this God, he thinks he is God because he defines God and he ascribes being God to himself and to himself only. So all these other folks who use the term God, they're using a borrowed term. And his discrimination, though, is just because it would be wrong to say, well... me and my buddies, we're God, or it'd be wrong to say I'm God, or that there's lots of others in this class, in this category. There's lots of gods. So for one God to say he's exclusive doesn't seem right. It's discriminating. Of course, you might have picked up that when God says I am God, he is expressing that Hebrew way of identifying himself as I am who I am, Exodus 3:14, you remember, Moses had asked, "Who is the God who is sending me to deliver Egypt?" And God said, "Tell them, I am sent you." What a flex. I am sent you. I don't need to say anything else. God, of course, repeats it later through Isaiah to the Israelites in Babylon. I am God. It is a statement of identity and a statement of discrimination. The covenant Lord of Israel is God. It's incomparable. He's incomparable. But he says also in verse 9, he says, there is no other. Again, reiterating the exclusivity of God. The exclusivity of God. The God of Israel, the God who says, I am God, also says that he is exclusive. I am God and there is no other. And again, this is very hard for modern people like ourselves to hear. I mean, sure, you might be trained up, you kind of know the right answers, but still, our instincts as modern people, it's hard for us because you and I are used to having options. We like options. We want options. You know, so you go, like after the rodeo, we went to McDonald's. Can I get a quarter pounder with cheese? And then if they were to say, sorry, there's only chicken McNuggets. And it would be like, oh, okay, I guess we got to leave because we don't eat chicken at McDonald's. Cowboys don't eat chicken after the rodeo. They only eat beef. No other options. No other options. Are you kidding me? Have that little bit of, you know, fast food rage or drive-through rage? What do you mean? There's no cream for my coffee. What are you talking about? I need my options. How dare you limit my options? But there's an exclusivity to God, which means there are no other options. There's none. C.S. Lewis wrote in a letter, I always found it fascinating. He said, speaking of Hinduism, of course, its pantheon of just endless multitudes of gods. C.S. Lewis says, Hinduism has no ability to say no. It has no ability to say no. No. There is no more. God is exclusive, and he says no. There is no other. And this is why then it's so remarkable, but still exclusive, that Jesus said in John 14:6, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. No, that's not a path. No, that's not an option over there. No, it's not acceptable. It's not one of many. No. It's no all over the place. No. Right here, only through Christ. Because there is no other God. And so if you're here this morning and you're kind of looking, maybe deep in your heart, maybe you're looking for a different path, you're looking for a different spirituality, you're looking for a different purpose in your life, then you are going to arrogantly, blindly, you will be going headlong to personal disaster because you are telling God that he's a liar. You're telling him he's a liar. You're telling God that he's a liar when he says, I am God and there is no other. You're saying, well, yeah, I'll keep you, God, but I'm also going to have these three other options as well. No, you're saying he's a liar. You can't have it both ways. But thirdly, this discrimination, this exclusivity. But thirdly, the incomparability of God. There is none like me. The truth is that not only is there no other God, there is no one or nothing that compares to God. So verse 9b, I am God and there is none like me. There is none like me. You know, it's been frequently said that atheism can't even describe itself without reference to God, the God it denies. It is a or non-theism. It still needs God as a reference point. So as much as atheists would like to climb up the ladder of infinity and peer at the rooftop where God lives by himself, they can't do it. So they have to speculate and say, well, they don't believe that God, the God that exists above, they pretend he doesn't exist, but they don't know, they haven't got a clue, because they can't get up there to see, to ascend such a height, because God is incomparable. There is none like me. And this means that our speculations about how we think God should act, or how God should govern, or how God should judge, or what God thinks, all of our speculations, all of these will assume that God is like us. And this becomes very relevant for the Calvinism discussion. Because before we even talk about any kind of TULIP acronym and those doctrines, most people have a problem thinking about God as not being like them. That's the fundamental issue. Often then, and the result is that we assume that God is simply a projection of the human mind. And he is not. There is none like me, he says. Of course, that's the case with the pagan gods. They were projections of people. It's the case with the modern psychology view of religion. But this relates specifically to the biblical truth of the doctrines of grace when we talk about that. Because as soon as we look at a doctrine like election or the extent of the atonement, then we're going to be tempted to make God like us, to bring him down, to make God conform to our expectations, and to make God fit into our box. But the true God is incomparable. Look at verse 10. He says, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. Like nobody else compares. This God speaks. He is not silent, as Francis Schaeffer made the point. He's not silent like the idols. He declares the end, not at the end. He declares it from the beginning. Nobody else can do that. You don't know if it's going to snow or be sunny next week. You haven't got a clue. The weather people don't. They're never right. He declares the end from the beginning, and it stands like he accomplishes it. He is then incomparable, without compare. And so with this, I just want to then make a few applications just to bring it to a close. And thinking about this Calvinism, but more so thinking about the incomparable God, our starting point. And the first thing to recognize is God is not like a man. He's not like a man. Even when there is analogous language that is used of God, we always have to make sure that we see that God is different. So God is described as Father. He's revealed his fatherhood. He's actually revealed what human fatherhood is. And although there are similarities, God is still in a class by himself. So he's not like a man. At the same time, God is creator. He is creator. Psalm 115, verse 3, our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases because he is the creator. He is the owner. God is in a class by himself, and as Genesis 1 tells us, he creates out of nothing. We only create from what has already been created. So he's different than us. So he's not like a man. He is a creator. He's not like a finite system. When we learn about the attributes of God and the doctrines of grace and the philosophical categories in which theologians have come to speak about God, mostly by narrowing down what God is not, that's how theologians have to do it. It's difficult to describe God, so they have to just say what God is not. When we do that, we can start putting God into this nicely controlled box. Now, if that's the case, we've certainly got it all wrong, because there's none like him. And he's not like a finite system. That doesn't mean that God is formless and void, but he reveals himself, and we have to be content to know that what he has revealed is a portion of who he is. He is not hidden, but he is still hidden, but he is knowable. There's so much we don't know about God, but he is knowable because he's revealed things to us. And as a result, Exodus 34, verse 6, we know that God is this way. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. That is this God. He's revealed himself that way. You wouldn't know. And I can guarantee each of you this week, you've thought that God only has a stick for you to beat you with. Why has this happened to me, God? And if he hadn't revealed that, well, he's actually merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, you wouldn't think that he was. But that's why you've got to trust what he tells you, how he interprets himself, rather than your interpretation of him. Don't put him into your finite system in a box. He's not like a finite system. But last, he's not like any option. And it's easy to think that God and our belief in God is optional. We can think that because we're free moral agents, we have options about where we place our faith. Faith in Allah, faith in Buddha, faith in ourselves. But there is no option. There is only God. He says, I am God, and there is none like me. Close with a story. When I was in China a number of years ago near Tibet, I visited the Tibetan Buddhist monastery there with my friend who is my interpreter. And it was sort of like religious Disneyland. I was surprised. Like, I was like, oh, wow, they're really making money here. And it's like, oh, yeah, the communist government, they make lots of money through taxes on this thing because of the tourists. Anyway, so we go in this monastery, and there's these massive statues of Buddha. It'd be about as tall as the ceiling here. Huge, huge Buddha idols. And, of course, in front of every idol of Buddha, there was a tray with lots of cash thrown in the tray as a donation. And so there's these multiple shrines and places to go and different rooms and all collecting money. And in the back of the monastery, there was another room that was much more modern. And in this modern room, there was these glass walls all around on all sides. And at the top of the glass walls were vents. It was a massive air conditioning unit. And I was like, what's going on here? What air conditioning? Why do they need all this air conditioning going on in here? But inside, there were other statues. And specifically, there was a statue of the great Buddha for all to worship. And the Buddha was made of butter. The butter Buddha drew all to worship him as God. But he couldn't survive without the air conditioning staying on. And yet that's how people throughout the world live. They make a butter Buddha. They craft one, spend lots of time with craftsmanship of making this butter Buddha in their lives. And they busy themselves frantically to maintain the lie that what they worship is real. It's got power. Oh, it's got power. But I've got to kind of reorder my life around it to keep it going. The idols that we're all tempted by are so much fakery. It's all just fakery. It's all smoke and mirrors. They're no more powerful than the butter Buddha. But God says, I am God, and there is no other. He says this, that he is incomparable. As it said back in Isaiah 45 and verse 22, he said, turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth. For I am God and there is no other. By myself I have sworn, from my mouth has gone out in righteousness a word that shall not return. To me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear allegiance. And of course, you know, Paul quotes from that and ascribes it to every knee will bow to Jesus Christ, Philippians 2:10. You see, if you want to know the incomparable God, you can look to Jesus Christ, the only Savior the world can ever know, and you can look to him and believe. And Jesus himself is incomparable because he is the true God. And so you are summoned to forsake your idols this morning and to believe in the true God. He is sovereign over us, and we can trust him through the fire and the flood. What's going to happen to all your butter Buddhas when you go through the fire and the flood? They're going to melt. They aren't going to be there. But he will be. And then you can have the confidence, even from this doxology, from Jude. Now to him who is able to keep you from stumbling and to present you blameless before the presence of his glory with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, through Jesus Christ, our Lord, be glory, majesty, dominion, and authority before all time, now and forever. And to that, you can all say, if you believe that, you can say, amen. Go in peace. You're dismissed.